from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Imagine Peace Tower was visualized with love and realized with love. It is a gift from John and Yoko and the people of Iceland to the world.
Yoko Ono, artist, musician, peace activist. She's just returned from Iceland, where she unveiled the Imagine Peace Tower in honor of her late husband, John Lennon.
We're going to stay in bed for 7 days, sort of, instead of having a private honeymoon. It's a private protest.
For the violence that's going in the world, you see?
To say,
we feel that instead of making war, it's better to just stay in bed. Let's stay in bed for 3 days.
And grow your hair.
Yes.
For peace. Let it grow till peace comes, you know.
Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive. Yoko Ono for the hour. All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Verizon Communication, the nation's second largest telecom company, has admitted it turned over the private telephone records of its customers to the government 94,000 times since 2005. Verizon made the admission in a letter to congressional Democrats. The Washington Post reports that in about 700 of the cases, Verizon turned over records even when federal investigators did not have a court order. AT&T and Quest also responded to inquiries from Congress, but declined to say how often they handed over customer records. All three companies refused to answer most questions about their involvement in the government's domestic surveillance program. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union has accused the Pentagon of conniving with the FBI to obtain hundreds of financial telephone and internet records without court approval. The ACLU says the Pentagon secretly issued hundreds of national security letters to obtain the private records. ACLU attorney Melissa Goldman said, quote, "The expanded role of the military in domestic intelligence gathering is troubling. National security letters are secretly issued by the government to obtain access to personal customer records from internet service providers, financial institutions, and credit reporting agencies. Recipients of the national security letters are usually forbidden or gagged from disclosing that they have received the letters." The Turkish government has formally sought authorization from the Turkish parliament to invade northern Iraq and attack Kurdish rebel groups. The Turkish parliament is widely expected to approve the authorization later this week. A spokesperson for the Turkish cabinet said an attack is not imminent.
Sınır ötesi harekat ve müdahalede bulunabilmesine imkan veren bir hükümet tezkeresi.
A permission request from the government to have an over-border operation has been sent to Turkish parliament with the signatures of the prime minister and all other ministers today.
Temennimiz bu tezkerenin kullanılmasına hiç imkan.
Our wish is not to use this motion. I hope we will not need this. But as you all know, the most painful reality of our country and our region is the reality of terror.
Meanwhile, Turkey's actions have caused alarm throughout the Middle East. The Iraqi government urged Turkey to be patient and not to resort to military action. On Monday, the price of oil shot up to a record high of $86 a barrel. Energy analyst Julian Lee linked the spike in oil prices to the situation in Turkey.
I think the immediate concern is Turkey's threats over possible military action in northern Iraq in response to incursions that it has seen that it believes are emanating from that part of the country. Although that's unlikely to have any impact on the bulk of Iraqi production, which comes from the south of the country, all of the increases that we've seen from Iraq in the last couple of months have come from production at the northern fields and, importantly, have been exported via a pipeline that runs through Turkey.
A former top U.S. general has admitted the war in Iraq was about oil. Former CENTCOM commander General John Abizaid told an audience at Stanford University, quote, "Of course it's about oil. We can't really deny that." Abizaid went on to say, quote, "We've treated the Arab world as a collection of big gas stations. Our message to them is, guys, keep your pumps open, prices low, be nice to the Israelis, and you can do whatever you want." General Abizaid's comments comes 1 month after former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan wrote that, quote, "The Iraq war is largely about oil." Meanwhile, new questions are being raised over how a personal friend of President Bush secured an oil deal with the Kurdish regional government in Iraq. The Texas-based company Hunt Oil signed a deal in September. Hunt's CEO, Ray Hunt, has been a key Republican fundraiser. He sits on the board of directors of Halliburton and is a member of the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board under an appointment from President Bush. On Monday, Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman and Dennis Kucinich questioned whether Hunt used non-public information learned from his position on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board to further his company's economic interests. Three Iraqi newspaper employees were killed near Kirkuk on Monday during an ambush. Killed in the attacks was the editor of the Al-Watan newspaper and two security guards. On Sunday, a Washington Post correspondent was shot dead in Baghdad. The Guardian newspaper reports six Iraqi resistance groups have taken a step toward unifying the factions fighting the U.S. by announcing the creation of a political umbrella organization. A spokesperson described the alliance as the Political Council of the Iraqi Resistance. The six Sunni groups said they are opposed to al-Qaeda in Iraq, but vowed to continue to attack U.S. occupation forces. The new political alliance has refused to recognize the government led by Nouri al-Maliki. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said Monday it's now time for the establishment of a Palestinian state. Rice made the comment during a news conference in the West Bank city of Ramallah. The Bush administration is prodding Israel and the Palestinian faction Fatah to take part in U.S.-sponsored Mideast talks this fall. Rice said, quote, the United States sees the establishment of a Palestinian state and a two-state solution as absolutely essential for the future, not just of Palestinians and Israelis, but also for the Middle East and indeed to American interests. Rice said Israel and leaders from Fatah must agree on how and when to start formal peace talks.
But it's hard. I was standing in this room several months ago when all of the questions were, would anybody be willing to talk about the core issues? And now we're talking about a joint document that will seriously and substantively address core issues. We've come quite a long way. We've got quite a long way to go. But we're not going to tire until I've given it my last ounce of energy and my last moment in office.
Meanwhile, a peace concert promoting a two-state solution has been called off after threats were made to Palestinians supporting the event. The concert was scheduled to take place on Thursday in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv and the West Bank town of Jericho. The International Atomic Energy Agency has announced that it has no information to support claims that Syria may be building a nuclear reactor. On Sunday, the New York Times reported that an Israeli airstrike on Syria last month targeted a partially built nuclear reactor that was modeled on one in North Korea. The IAEA has urged the U.S. and other countries to share any intelligence it has on such nuclear-related activities with the UN nuclear watchdog. The European Union has widened its sanctions against Burma by adding a ban on the imports of timber, gemstones, and precious metals. But the EU shied away from targeting Burmese oil and gas exports or to prevent European companies from operating in those sectors in Burma. On Monday, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown urged the international community to support Burma's economic recovery if the military junta agreed to democratic reforms.
We will continue to press the Burmese regime to make changes. We will continue to give support to Aung San Suu Kyi and those people who are fighting for reconciliation and democracy, and we will continue to ensure that the gaze of the whole world is upon this repressive regime so that the changes that are necessary, so that human rights are respected and that we can begin to make progress.
Meanwhile, a group of jewelers in the United States is calling on Congress to bar Burmese gems from being imported to the United States from third countries. Burma is world-renowned for its rubies. It also has a wealth of jadeite and sapphires. U.S. and Iraqi officials are reportedly negotiating Baghdad's request that the private military company Blackwater be expelled from the country within 6 months, following last month's deadly shootout in Baghdad. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports Blackwater is attempting to expand its operations elsewhere. The company recently outbid Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon for a five-year, $15 billion Pentagon contract to fight terrorists with drug ties. The U.S. government reportedly wants to use contractors to help its allies thwart drug trafficking and provide equipment, training, and people. New government statistics show the gap between America's richest and poorest is at its widest in at least 25 years. The richest 1% of the country earned over 21% of all income in 2005. And on Capitol Hill, the House Judiciary Committee is holding a key hearing on the Gina Six case. The Reverend Al Sharpton and other civil rights leaders are scheduled to testify. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez with Amy Goodman.
And welcome to our viewers and listeners around the country and around the world. Well, today we spend the hour with Yoko Ono, artist, musician, peace activist. She's here in the Firehouse studio with us just days after returning from Iceland, where she unveiled a project 40 years in the making, the Imagine Peace Tower. Dedicated to her late husband, John Lennon, the tower shoots light into the sky and bears the inscription, Imagine Peace. It will light up every year between October 9th, the day of John Lennon's birth, and December 8th, the day of his death. Today, we speak with Yoko Ono about this latest project and her long and sometimes overlooked career as a prolific artist and innovator. We'll also talk about her husband, John Lennon, and how their political activism together led to government surveillance and deportation attempts from the Nixon administration. But first, this is an excerpt of Yoko Ono's speech unveiling the Imagine Peace Tower 1 week ago today.
We are here together, billions of us, standing at the dawn of a new age, determined to shift the axis of the world to health, peace, and joy by loving and caring for all lives on Earth. Some of us are here physically. Some are joining us in spirit. Some of us are imprisoned, tortured, maimed, and silenced. But they are also here today with us. Some of us have passed away before being able to enjoy a new age of love and peace. But we are all here today, standing together with hope. The light is the light of wisdom, healing, and empowerment. Even in the moments of confusion, fear, and the darkness of your souls, hold the light in your hearts, and you will know that you are not alone, that we are all together in seeing the light of peace.
Yoko Ono, speaking a week ago in Reykjavik, Iceland. Among those joining her to unveil the statue is Sean Lennon, her only child with John Lennon. John Lennon's fellow Beatle Ringo Starr was also there. Yoko Ono joins us now in the Firehouse studio for the hour. Welcome to Democracy Now! Thanks so much.
Good morning, Amy.
It's great to be with you. Tell us about this monument in Iceland.
Well, about 40 years ago, I think in 1965, so it's 42 years ago, I thought of this idea of having a lighthouse, a light tower, and that only emerges when the environment and the, you know, the weather and everything is right. And I just like that concept that there's a tower that isn't just staying there, but depends on the environment, that it just comes out. And right now, I think because it's a peace tower, and it's kind of blinking, which is very, very, I think, real and true to what's going on now. It's blinking in a sense that it comes out only from John's birthday to John's the day that he passed away. And so it's a small, but you know, it just shows how life is. Life is short, but the light and the concept of light is eternal.
And why Iceland?
Well, the reason is because Iceland is a very, very unique country. And right now, everywhere, all different countries are suffering because of oil and the shortage of oil, and they're fighting over oil. I mean, oil is always the sort of like the reason to go to war, something like that. But in Iceland, 80% of the energy is done by geothermal, meaning water. Water is supplying the energy instead of oil. And it's a very, very interesting thing that they're doing. What happened was, in the Depression, 1930s, around then, they realized that they were using coal as the energy source. And they realized that they couldn't buy any more coal, and it just the whole country would just dissipate. So they found a way at the time how to use their resources, which was the geothermal energy. And from then on, they started geothermal energy instead of oil. And so they're very independent from that sort of struggle of getting oil. And it's very beautiful.
So you conceived of this before John was killed. He knew about this idea?
No, he didn't know about this idea. We didn't know anything about this. Oh, what we knew was that I thought of building a light tower. And John loved that idea, the light tower that just emerges once in a while. And so he actually invited me in 1967, the first time that he invited me to his house in Kenwood. And I was wondering what it was about. I thought it was a party or something, but no, it was a very quiet day. And he said, well, actually, I invited you because I wanted to know if you can build the lighthouse in my garden, which was, and I said, oh, dear, no, it's just a conceptual idea. I don't know how to build anything. And it was just laughing. But that's when he wanted this light tower. And that was 40 years ago. And now, and that was 67, and it's a very strange numerological thing, you know, because this year is his 67th birthday. And I didn't plan it that way, it just happened, you know, this sort of, we're having this unveiling of the lighthouse.
And imagine peace is written in 24 languages.
24 languages. And, you know, somebody's, I'm sure, somebody will come out and say, well, what about this language, that language? So we have about space for another 10 languages on the wall.
Yeah. And the response of the people of Iceland?
Oh, well, people in Iceland, I hope, and I saw this sort of, I witnessed the fact that they were all very, very happy. They were ecstatic. One of the reasons is because the winter is rather dark in Iceland. And, you know, they like the idea that there's light in the winter, yeah.
We're talking to Yoko Ono, musician, artist, peace activist, just back from Reykjavik, from Iceland, where she unveiled the Imagine Peace Tower. It's a light tower dedicated to her late husband, John Lennon.
And, you know, there are many interesting things about this surrounding this, because I think that they found out that Edgar Cayce said something about there'll be a tower of light in the northern, foremost northern country, which will spread peace to the world, something like that. I think Edgar Cayce said that. So I don't know. You know, it seems like somehow I'm fulfilling the prediction or something. But I didn't know that. And, you know, they told me about that in Iceland.
And you have a website, imaginepeace.com.
Ah, yes, imaginepeace.com. Please, you know, click into imaginepeace.com because it's then you will know all the stories about it.
Well, throughout your life, you've merged your political activism with your art.
Yes.
Could you talk about that and how you've tried to use your art to get messages out?
Well, I think that all of us, not just artists, but, well, when I say artists, I think people who consider themselves artists, I think that everybody, if they want to be an artist, they can be. And also, we're using this creative energy of being an artist to just fulfill what we have to do in a sense that all of us live in this society and we're all responsible of what happens in the society, not just artists. And so I'm just doing what I can do. That's all, you know. But I just want to tell you this very interesting thing that happened. So in Toronto a couple of weeks ago, that a male student was wearing a pink shirt and he was gay. And so he was harassed and he was ostracized. And so the next day, his friends all wore pink shirts. And this is sort of like spreading. Now, there are many people who are wearing pink shirts and other school students are asking, well, what can we do, you know? And I think that this, we're living in a situation that there's a lot of fear and confusion. And, you know, some people are very pessimistic about the future. But I really think that we can do it. We can survive. And, you know, it's so natural for us to want to survive. It's a very strong sort of instinct in us. And we are going to do it. And it, I see that all sorts of beautiful things are starting to happen. And they're all writing to me in imaginepeace.com. So I like you to, you know, click in, and then you'll see these things are happening. There's another thing that happened very recently. I don't know if this is very recent. Well, I think it is. I better read it so that it's just sort of, I'll be very exact about it. In September, a project was launched with the aim at storing CO2 in Iceland's lavas by injecting the greenhouse gas into basaltic bedrock, where it literally turns to stone. Now, carbon dioxide turning into calcite is a well-known natural process in volcanic areas, and now the scientists of the University of Iceland, Columbia University in New York, and the CNRS in Toulouse, France, are developing methods to imitate and speed up this transformation of the gas that is a prevalent contributor to global warming. So that, you know, they're fighting global warming. And it's very interesting. I saw this lava sort of kind of looking ugly kind of stone. And then they showed me how it was calcified into a beautiful, beautiful sort of like a crystal. And so that's what they're trying to do now, and lessen the global warming. So, of course, we have to do more to lessen the global warming, but that's another way of they're trying to do it. And I think we're going to hack it. I think we're going to do it.
We're talking to Yoko Ono. We'll be back with her in a minute. Now, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we were playing that song for our TV viewers, Yoko Ono, we were showing images. One of them was a poster that said, "The war is over." Explain.
Well, one day I thought, well, it's great to say war is over and have all these people. Well, this was the first idea, that I would have many famous people partying in Ascot House. And then somebody would just come in and say, "War is over." And they all say, "Oh my God, the war is over, if you want it." But the thing is, then, you know, we decided to do it as a poster, and then John decided to do it in a billboard, and it just became "War is over, if you want it." It was much better than having a party and then having some TV camera crew to come and film it and all that, because it was a much better idea. So we just did it that way.
I wanted to go for a minute to a clip of a documentary called The U.S. versus John Lennon. It was directed by John Scheinfeld. It chronicles, well, your husband, John Lennon, and also Yoko Ono, their political activism around the Vietnam War and other issues of social justice in the 60s and 70s, and how the activism led to government surveillance and persecution of them. This clip looks at how John and Yoko spent their honeymoon by staging a week-long bet-in against the Vietnam War.
Drove from Paris to the Amsterdam Hilton. Talking in our beds for a week. The news people said, say what you're doing in bed. I said, we're only trying to get us some peace. Christ, you know it ain't easy.
We're going to stay in bed for 7 days, sort of, instead of having a private honeymoon. It's a private protest.
For the violence that's going in the world, you see.
To say,
we feel that instead of making war, it's better to just stay in bed. Let's stay in bed for 3 days.
And grow your hair.
Yes.
For peace. Let it grow till peace comes, you know.
What the press really wants is a picture of John and Yoko in bed on their honeymoon. And then they turned it around and said, well, in that case, let them have a picture of John and Yoko in bed on their honeymoon, but put the word peace in it.
So they all thought we were going to make love in bed. See, and all the press from all around the world came, and we opened the, our helpers opened the door, and they fighting to get in, the, you know, like this with the cameras. And then their faces dropped, we're sitting like angels saying, hello, peace, brother. And all their faces dropped, and we were just in bed.
And you were wearing
we thought it was a great practical joke that most of the world's headline newspapers, especially the European and British, was married couple are in bed.
Oh, there had never been anything like it. It was completely original. You know, the conscious use of one's myth to project a political and social poetic goal. It had never happened before.
Up to then, people who were promoting world peace were kind of like intellectual, anemic kind of people. Just sort of like passing on pamphlets that nobody wants to read, you know? And so John was saying, no, that's why we wanted to do it this way, you know? And I think we did a great job.
Please stop this nonsense. Go home, we don't like people like you. Go to a doctor to be normal. Are you getting this?
It's great.
Go to a doctor to be normal. Well, we're seeing a psychiatrist today, so maybe he'll fix us up. Bloody marvellous.
When people are creative geniuses, you have to cut them some slack. You really have to cut them some slack. England isn't good at cutting slack for working class boys.
If it works, it's right.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, it's wrong.
Well, nobody's ever given it a chance before, have they? Nobody's ever given peace a complete chance. Gandhi tried it, Martin Luther King tried it, but they were shot. But nobody's given...
You can't get peace in a king-size divan on floor 802.
We don't expect to. I mean, we're talking mainly to the revolutionaries who think they can get it overnight by breaking down the buildings, you know. They can't get it. We thought about this for months. This is the best possible, most functional and effective way of promoting and protesting against violence that our minds combined could think of.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono in their bed-in, their honeymoon that they shared with the world. It's from the film, The U.S. versus John Lennon. Yoko Ono, you started the bed-in in Amsterdam?
Yes.
How did you conceive of this?
Well, that's something that John and I kind of discussed it and finally made it into a very practical kind of event together.
And the press response?
The press response wasn't, well, first of all, they thought they were going to make love or something in front of people, and that's why a lot of journalists came, but we weren't doing that. We were just talking about peace in bed, and maybe that disappointed them or something, I don't know, but we didn't think that we were going to get any flack, but we did. I think that the report in the papers were not very good. And we were surprised. We said, oh, dear, you know.
But you took it on the road.
Yes,
you did
yes.
it in Amsterdam and where else?
Well, we did it in Canada. But the thing is, that's all we were able to do because we were going to Canada and then we're going to go to United States. But somehow we couldn't do it in the United States at the time.
And this whole issue of the government surveillance of your activities at the time. So what degree did you realize the extent of the government's pursuit of you and your husband?
Well, you know, we knew it and we didn't, in a way. It's a very strange situation. And we couldn't tell anybody about it. We did tell some of our friends, but then they just thought that we were just being paranoid.
Let's go to another clip that talks about this. Another clip from the U.S. versus John Lennon, dealing with the FBI's spying on John Lennon and Yoko Ono, beginning with former Nixon administration official G. Gordon Liddy.
It was our perspective of Lennon that most of the time he was walking around stone, whacked out of his mind. But he was a high-profile figure, and so his activities were being monitored.
They knew for a fact that they didn't want hundreds, thousands, millions of young people attending a counter-convention, especially where John Lennon would perform.
I don't think he realized the strength of the American political establishment and how much power it could exert onto him with regard to silencing him or covert ways in which they might follow his activities.
We were sure that the phones were all tapped, and it was like most things, our wildest dreams did not begin to touch what they were actually doing against us.
Do you think that they are kind of picking on you, John?
Oh, yeah, they picked on me. I'm telling you, when it first started, I was followed in a car, and my phone was tapped, and I think they wanted me to know to scare me, and I was scared, paranoid. Mm. And people thought I was crazy then, you know. I mean, they do anyway, but I mean, more so, you know, Lennon. Oh, you big-headed maniac, right? Who's going to follow you around? Well, what do they want? You know, that's what I'm saying. What do they want? You know, I'm not going to cause them any problem.
It surprised me when I heard that Lennon had been under surveillance, that he'd been wiretapped, just as it did when I heard that Martin Luther King had been. These sort of things that came out of the FBI really caught me as being so unnecessary and so risky, and why?
I can't prove it, you know. I just know there's a lot of repairs going on in the cellar. I know the difference between the phone being normal when I pick it up and when every time I pick it up there's a lot of noises, you know. And I'd open the door and there'd be guys standing on the other side of the street. I'd get in the car and they'd be following me in a car and not hiding, you see. That's why I got a bit paranoid as well. They wanted me to see I was being followed, you know. Suddenly I realized this was serious, you know. They were coming for me one way or the other, you know. I mean, they were harassing me.
That's John Lennon, and it's from the film The U.S. versus John Lennon, the harassment of you and John under the Nixon administration as he was preparing to run for re-election in 1972. This tremendous fear that Nixon had coming out in the Freedom of Information Act documents, that John Lennon would be holding these Get Out the Vote concerts. You had this massive conference and concert in
yes.
Ann Arbor to free John Sinclair, and ultimately
yes.
he was.
I know. Well, you know, that John Lennon versus USA is a very good film, and it was produced by David Leep and directed by John Schoenfeld. And I really wish people would just go and buy the DVD or something like that, because it's, oh, you know, it might be circulating somewhere in maybe in internet. But it will show what John was doing. And after John's passing, there were so many stories about John, all sort of negative stuff, you know, about, oh, when in childhood he was violent or this, that, and the other. And they never get around to what John was really doing. And he was really working for world peace and was doing a great job at it, really, you know. And because of that, some people didn't like it, you know, and it was very dangerous for him. But he just laid out all the stuff that he thinks was very important to the world.
And for those who are younger and out there in the audience and know of you as the two of you as a famous couple, but don't know much else, how did you meet originally?
Oh, well, it was, I would say, I was just going to say it was just a coincidence or accidental meeting, which was true. But, you know, nothing is an accident or a coincidence, I'm sure. And, well, we didn't know that. And I went to London, leaving New York on September 1st. And John had a
what year was this?
1966. And John had a very difficult time in August of that year because people thought that he made the remark of the Beatles were bigger than Jesus Christ or something. And they sort of mistook it in many ways. And so that, you know, I think it was really dangerous for his life and all that too. I think maybe on a sort of a level of subconscious or something, that maybe he was asking for help. And I don't know, maybe I caught that message or something. I was leaving on September 1st to London. And then we met in Indica Gallery where I was doing my show. And before the opening, about an hour before the opening, he came into Indica Gallery. And I thought, why did the owner let him come in? You know, because I was telling the owner that nobody should come in before my before the opening, because I wanted to be very prepared, well prepared. And but this guy came in with the owner. So I said, what is this? You know. But then I thought, oh well, he must be a very close friend of the owner or something. I should be nice about it. But I wasn't that nice, really.
And that's how you met John Lennon.
Yeah, yeah.
Before that, as we talk about war now and the context of your lives was another war, was Vietnam, you survived the firebombing of Tokyo.
I know. And it was really, when I was a little girl, when I was very young. One day, I had high fever because of just a cold, but, you know, I had a cold. And so my family all went down into the basement to make sure that, you know, they're all right. It's a kind of shelter that they created in the garden, actually. But I couldn't go, and I was just sort of in my bed, and I saw that all the houses next to us and all the places around me were just all fire. And I go, oh. But, you know, when you're young, and that's the only reality you're walking through, you don't really get totally scared or anything. You know, you're just looking at it like an objective film or something like that. Oh, this is what's happening, you know. And because of that memory of what I went through in the Second World War, I think that it embedded in me how terrible it is to go through war.
Your father was a prisoner of war taken in China?
He was in French Indochina, which is Vietnam, actually. It's a very strange sort of, you know, fate, isn't it, that he actually was in Vietnam. It was called French Indochina, Indochina in those days. And he was in Saigon. And he was in a concentration camp. And my mother and I and my brother and sister, younger brother and sister, we were all in Japan. And we were sort of concerned about him. But also, we had very little to eat, you know. And then there was a little rice bowl that we would sort of split between us or something. But before we split the rice bowl, rice in the rice bowl, my mother would just give the rice bowl to my father's photograph, you know, like saying, dedicating to him so he would have something to eat. And we're all just waiting. It was amazing, yeah.
I'd like to get back to some of the art that you've done in terms of getting political messages. Back in 2000, you did art exhibitions both at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem and in an Arab town in northern Israel.
That happened, yes.
Have you seen the horizon lately?
Yes, yes.
What was the reaction there at the time, and what were you hoping to do? And especially now that we're hearing about possibility of another peace conference over the continuing conflict in the occupied territories?
Well, I really think that we're going to start to tap into our wisdom, open up true nature of wanting peace and wanting to survive. And I think we are going to do that. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I'm sure that it will happen very quickly. I mean, the way that we're dealing with the global warming, how, you know, the 140 countries are capable of doing the same thing, of changing their energy source to geothermal, which is water. And when you do that, something very interesting happens. In Iceland, air is clean, the water is clean, and the earth is clean, And when I was there, my sister was saying, did you notice that there was no dust on the windowsill in the hotel? And I think, no dust? I mean, we come from New York where dust is sort of like a normal situation of the day. But anyway, so that's what's going to happen to the world. We're going to quickly make sure that we are not dependent on oil. Isn't that great? And that's going to happen, of course. And meanwhile, we're going to change the global warming in such a way, like I told you about this, about sort of the project's implication for the fight against global warming are considerable, since basaltic bedrock susceptible to CO2 injections are widely found on the planet. Are we going to do it?
You're very optimistic.
Well, you know, most people say, oh, you're so optimistic. I mean, what's wrong with you? I'm not really that optimistic. I'm trying to make us survive. And in the course of survival, we don't have the luxury to be negative. That's a luxury that we can't afford. And we just have to do what we can do. And I think that instead of getting so upset with some people, you know, or some country which are doing this, doing that, how dare they, or whatever, I think we should just do what we can do.
We're going to go to break and come back to Yoko Ono. She's our guest for the hour here on Democracy Now! Stay with us. Plastic Ono Band, Give Peace a Chance. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Yoko Ono. When you and John were in this country, President Nixon was trying to deport your husband.
Yes.
For your opposition to the Vietnam War.
I know.
How did Paul McCartney feel about John speaking out on Vietnam?
Well, I think you have to ask Paul about that.
Did John feel pressure from the Beatles not to be so political?
Well, I think that was already maybe when he made a remark about the Beatles were bigger than Christ or something like that, which actually was true at the time. And he was really concerned about that. He was an incredible sort of enthusiastic Christian, actually. I think that he didn't like that fact. But it was reported in a very strange way. And at the time, I think that the band was a little bit upset about that, you know. But other than that, they were never sort of critical or criticizing us.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another clip of the documentary U.S. versus John Lennon, which looks at the Nixon administration trying to have John Lennon deported on drug charges. It begins with Leon Wildes, John Lennon's immigration attorney.
I sued the Attorney General, Mitchell, and a whole slew of other people who I claimed were involved in a conspiracy to deny John and Yoko's case and get them out of the United States improperly.
What do you think your chances are of remaining in this country?
99-1.
For or against?
For.
Why is that?
Because I'm overconfident as usual.
We ultimately were able to examine the records in the case, and lo and behold, deep in John's immigration file, which was a high security file, were documents reaching all the way up to President Nixon, showing improper interference in an immigration case and prejudgment.
Probably the most important documents in the Lennon FBI file are reports addressed to the White House, signed by J. Edgar Hoover. Now, these were not sent directly to Richard Nixon. They're addressed to H.R. Haldeman, assistant to the president. Now, Haldeman was the most important person in the White House if you wanted to get to Nixon. So when Hoover sends something to Haldeman saying, here's our report on our progress in trying to kick Lennon out of the country, the reason that he's doing that is that Nixon wants to know.
I would not say that it was integral to the politics of the Nixon administration to keep John Lennon from having residence in this country. I think it was of a piece with the general nastiness of the Nixon administration.
An excerpt of U.S. versus John Lennon. How scared were you that you were going to be kicked out, that John was?
Well, we weren't that scared. It's very interesting. We were that naive about it, but we felt that it's going to be all right. And I think that Leon Wiles really did a very good job. He did a very zen thing, actually, and I think that maybe we should all learn from it. But instead of fighting the immigration or fighting the administration, he started to just postpone it and kept postponing. And I think that worked.
And so John was not deported. We just saw one of the documents, classified documents, that said John Winston Lennon. As we were watching it, you said, actually, John Winston Ono Lennon, but they didn't say that.
Right. Well, he changed his name to John Ono Lennon. There was a big sort of ceremony we did in London, and he changed his name. But we found out that they cannot really take out Winston. So it had to be John Winston Ono Lennon, yeah.
How important is feminism to you?
Well, I think it's very important for all of us, not just for women, but for men as well. It's a very important thing for the world.
Why?
Well, because, you know, women power is very, very strong. And by ignoring it or abusing it, the world is not getting any benefit from doing that.
This summer, you headlined the Pitchfork Music Festival in Chicago. Most of the people there were the 20s and 30s, and your message, it seems to be reaching across the generations now, the relevance of getting so many young people to hear you.
Well, you know, I don't have a concept of young and old in a way. I never ask people, how old are you, you know, because I really think that the age of that person is the age of that person's spirit. And some people are very young and some people are very old. Even when they're 18, they can be very old.
I wanted to ask you about the media. To say the least, your life has been framed by the media. But you also, you and John, were very good at dealing with the media.
I don't know about that.
Well, I wanted to go back to one last clip from the film, U.S. versus John Lennon. And it is Gloria Emerson of the New York Times challenging John Lennon.
If I'm going to get on the front page, I might as well get on the front page with the word peace.
But you've made yourself ridiculous.
To some people, I don't care.
If
it saves lives.
You don't think you... Oh, my dear boy, you're living in another nether.
Well, you talk to
them. You don't think you saved a single life.
Will you tell me, what were they singing at the moratorium?
Which I mean, the moratorium is throughout the nation.
Well, the one here, the recent big one, they were singing Give Peace a Chance, you know.
A song of yours, probably.
Well, yes, and it was written specifically for them.
So they sang one of your songs.
Well, if you...
Great song, sure, but is that all you can say about that, the moratorium?
You were saying that in America they're so serious about the protest movement.
Yes, they are.
But they were so flippant that they were singing a happy-go-lucky song, which happens to be one I wrote, and I'm glad they sang it. And when I get there, I'll sing it with them.
John Lennon responding to the New York Times, Gloria Emerson. Yoko Ono, do you remember that interview?
Oh, of course I remember that very well. And these days when I if I see that part of the film, I just feel sorry for Gloria Emerson. You know, we really have to understand that, you know, we make mistakes sometimes. And that's sort of repeated all the time. It's like, well, we just have to know that all of us do make mistakes. And we have to forgive each other. And this is just part of it. I really want to forgive her because I feel that she must be embarrassed by now, and also her family, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, John was very upset about that situation, and rightly so. And if he was here now, I think he'd be extremely upset.
About the situation in the world
today? Oh, about the situation of the world, yeah.
What do you think he would be doing today?
Well, I think that we'll be doing exactly what we've been doing then. I think this time it's not bad in it. We can't repeat the act, but probably he'll be in Iceland with me standing at the Imagine Peace Tower. And I really felt that he was standing with me. And Ringo was there, and I thought that was very nice that he came. But he even gave me a little sort of rubber bracelet. And I said, white rubber bracelet. I said, what is this for? Oh, it's for peace, and I'm sort of giving it to people. And that was very nice of him. And also, Olivia Harrison, she's an incredibly intelligent woman. And somehow, she was kind of overshadowed by George Harrison, of course. But they were doing things together. And I just know that now because she's been so helpful with the Apple situation in many ways.
Over the years, you've collaborated with many artists, John Cage, the composer, Andy Warhol. Could you talk about some of your favorite collaborations that you've had?
Well, my favorite, of course, is with John Lennon. And before that, yes, I had some collaborations with people. And they were all very good, actually, you know. I enjoyed them. And I feel that I was very lucky to have had those encounters. Very interesting, isn't it? That most people would not have all that in different fields. I mean, Ornette Coleman was jazz, and John Cage was avant-garde, and John Lennon was rock and roll, you know.
And what is your next plan, your next project?
Well, and then I have to tell you that I have collaborated with my son as well. That's my latest, I suppose. I don't know. I mean, I have so many things that I'm still working on now. And if I started telling you that, you'd just be nodding off.
Well, let me ask you about how you feel having really dealt with the Nixon administration in a very personal way, from the surveillance to the attempted deportation, to the war, to the Vietnam War. How do you think the Bush administration compares to the Nixon administration?
Well, I'm not that concerned about professional politicians, because I always believe that we can only change the world by grassroots movements, because in grassroots, there's so many people, really, you know, and it's a very important thing to do through grassroots. And so I think that, you know, we're doing all right. I think it's very a wasteful thing to focus our attention too much on other people's, what other people are doing and being critical of it. And when I'm asked the same question in the world, in Europe or in Iceland, wherever, Asia, I always say that this is the first time that I realized that I respect the Americans so much, because there's so many Americans standing up for peace and trying to change the world and trying to shift the axis of the world to peace, despite the fact that it's rather dangerous to do that, maybe, and they're very courageous. It's a very courageous thing to do. It's, well, I don't want to compare with that because it's a different, totally different thing. But whenever New York had a blackout, we found that the New Yorkers were very peaceful people and that we helped each other. It's like that, you know. It's like now there's so many beautiful people standing up courageously for world peace, in the United States. And I want the world to know that. And I always say that, you know, whenever I go, wherever I go, they say, how do you like what's going on with America now? And I'm saying, well, there are many people who are standing up for peace. And for the first time, I really strongly respect Americans and proud of it, too.
And when you say that there's so many standing up for peace, certainly in terms of the numbers that are, when it comes to war, coming out into the streets to try to stop this war, it's certainly not at the level that it was in the period during Vietnam.
Wait a second. In the Vietnam War, there were things that we did that was sort of effective, maybe, marching and all that. And the marching is not bad either. But I think that we're learning other ways of really trying to affect the world. And you know, like they say that all people in China would just jump up and down at once, then they can shift the axis of the globe. Now, the many, many people, all of us, are visualizing world peace and to survive, to want to survive. And you know, by doing that together, like billions of us, we are going to shift the axis of the world to peace. And I believe that.
In the situation in Burma, your thoughts on San Suu Kyi remains under house arrest for so many years.
Yes.
You've got the U.S. oil company Chevron continuing to do business with the military junta. You've got China's support as well of the regime, the rounding up of we don't know how many Buddhist monks and other citizens of Burma.
Well, you see, in old days, it was just the monks who were meditating and changing the world by meditation. Now, I sent a message to all people who are in a situation where they're being persecuted by administrations and asking them to try to survive. Because just the fact that they are in this world now and to exercise their spirit to influence other people with very powerful spirits that they have. We are benefiting from that. And I don't want them to die. I want them to really try to survive. And I will do the same.
Finally, Yoko Ono, how did you cope with John's death, with his murder at such a young age, at the age of 40?
I know. It was very difficult. Very, very difficult, yeah.
And in helping others who are dealing with this all over the world, whether through war, through natural causes, through murder, as your husband died so violently, what thoughts do you have today?
Well, you see, actually, when you said helping the world, I just remembered that after John's passing, and I was feeling so depressed that I didn't know if, you know, it was... if there was any point in keeping and being alive or something. But then I realized that there's so many girls who are jumping off the roof or something and trying to commit suicide because John died and everything. And suddenly it woke me up. I said, I have to help these people who are in distress. And that really made me come out of the depression in a way. And also the other one was... my son, Sean, I could not sort of leave him alone. And that was a very strong element. But especially when I heard about, when I read about the girls who were trying to sort of commit suicide.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending the hour with us today. Yoko Ono has been our guest, musician, artist, peace activist. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Carrie Mache, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.